In this room, known as the soul trap, was a special box equipped with electronic sensors, strain gauges, light beams and other gadgets to detect any disturbance in the box. Tanis was supposed to go inside and look through a special lens. Only through this lens could anyone see a picture randomly selected of a symbol and a colored background. In other words, Tanis had to be inside the box to identify the picture. Dr. Rosa says Tanis succeeded in naming these randomly produced images more frequently than should be possible by lucky guesses. There were also weight changes on the strain gauges indicating some presence in the box, at the times when Tanis said he was out of body. Other sensors such as a television camera and a temperature gauge did not detect any change. Once Dr. Rosas tried another kind of measurement. Without telling Tanis, he put another psychic in the room with the apparatus, to see if she could sense anything. Tanis was 5 closed doors away, when during this experiment, the psychic suddenly began laughing uncontrollably. She said she could see a man floating about near the ceiling, with arms and legs waving. It looked hilarious. Afterwards, Tanis told Osis he had been unable to complete the test because he became stuck near the ceiling, and could not project himself any lower. Struggle as he might, he said, he could not get down to the box to identify the target picture. The test, he thought, was a failure. Tanis, a star performer for Dr. Osis, preferred to work from inside his booth because in this way he was free from all eyes of observers and could more easily enter into a state of consciousness he found conducive to psi. Not all psychics are visualizers like Tanis, who scanned the scene of a crime with his mind's eye. Some are verbalizers, who repeat words and phrases which just pop into their minds. Others are doers, who express themselves in gestures and actions. Paper and pencil are key aids for them. Some are map dowsers who hold a pendulum over a map to identify a target. The pendulum moves in small circles above the correct spot. Dr. Rosa says the movement of the pendulum is caused by slight muscle actions in the hand. Controlled by the subconscious mind of the dowser, it can be as valid a method of expression as speech. Psychometry is another useful link between psychic and target, using a token object which has been in close contact with the person about whom information is wanted. This object could be a piece of clothing, a watch, a pocket knife. Handling this gives the psychic a connection to the past and to that person. Ideally, we would like objects from both the victim and the perpetrator. In most homicides, the clothing of the victim has been touched by the killer and so can be a link to both persons. And when it works, says Dr. Rosas, the psychic often witnesses a scene of great horror or brutality. The effect can be as traumatic as for any other witness. Sometimes a psychic unconsciously delays seeing acts of brutality or murder. When finally confronting the events, they become overwhelmed with emotion, moved to tears. Such work is, to say the least, very taxing. At times the trauma is so strong that either the flow of imagery halts, before the final event is visualized, or the psychic avoids the spectacle by switching to fictional ESP which, like daydreaming, does not have a powerful impact, says Osis. Some psychics are so disturbed, they need therapy before they are ready to tackle another case. Today, although many scientists deny that psi is real and say any successes are due to coincidence, exaggeration or plain trickery, Dr. Rosa stands by his belief that psi has a potential value in fighting crime. However, he knows its limitations. The state of the art is still incomplete. A disproportionate amount of misses as compared with successes was apparent in our casework. Before ESP can be effectively used to solve crimes, he says, improved methods and procedures are needed, new equipment, and better trained psi practitioners and police investigators. When methods of applying ESP become operational, there will be no walls for the criminal to hide behind, no location that could not be seen. Could there be a better deterrent than that? Dr. Rosa's view is that murder could be significantly reduced if the use of psychics led to the arrest and conviction of more murderers. There are 25,000 murders in America each year, a huge total. 80s. If as many people died in avoidable accidents, there would be a public outcry. In my opinion, this annual slaughter can be reduced by developing the SI techniques we have talked about. The same benefits can be gained in other parts of the world. Chapter 4, Rubbing Strange Stones Together, unless there is a gigantic conspiracy involving 30 university departments all over the world, and several hundred highly respected scientists in various fields, many of them originally hostile to the claims of psychical researchers. The only conclusion the unbiased observer can come to must be that there does exist a small number of people who obtain knowledge, existing either in other people's minds or in the outer world, by means as yet unknown to science. Professor Hans J. Eersink: the overwhelming majority of scientists do not believe in the paranormal. They reject the idea that part of a person's mind may exist outside the body, can pluck thoughts from another mind, or see things remotely, sometimes even into the future. And yet there is hard scientific evidence, from hundreds of repeatable laboratory tests, computer analyzed, suggesting such things may be possible. Most scientists who dismiss psi phenomena out of hand as superstitious nonsense have almost certainly never read Charles R. Norton's analysis of 15 years of Ganzfeld tests in 14 different laboratories. His statistical conclusion to this vast series of remote viewing tests is that the odds against the high success rate being due to chance or lucky guesses are trillions to one. A Ganzfeld test, like the remote viewing described in the first chapter, is an experiment in seeing at a distance. The difference is that in Ganzfeld everything happens within the laboratory. Nobody ventures into the outside world, and the aim is to thought transmit an image from one room to another in a totally scientific setting. No one with an open mind should be deterred from learning more about these remarkable experiments just because scientific orthodoxy rejects the findings in advance. A 1982 survey of top scientists in America showed that even the minority who accept the possibility of the paranormal do so mostly without having read the volumes of scientific evidence produced by their colleagues in parapsychology. Their belief is mainly due to personal conviction or seemingly paranormal incidents in their private lives. Most scientists know little of modern psi research. Naturally, as part of our television series, we tried a Ganzfeld experiment for ourselves. N, the BBC's Tessa Caudle was the subject, and the result was once more strange and quite striking. The outcome was a miss to the parapsychologists, but to us laymen of the television team it certainly looked as if there was some psychic force at work, almost enough to persuade us to set up my assistant in a small tent with a crystal ball, Madame Tessa, clairvoyant. Four picture slides were randomly selected as possible targets, all quite unknown to Tessa. A sender tried to communicate one of them telepathically to Tessa, from another room. He was not successful. Scientifically, the experiment seemed a total failure, but more had happened than at first we realized. When all four chosen slides were looked at, it was found that Tessa had precisely named two of them and had given an accurate general impression of the third. It was as if, instead of telepathically seeing the one picture in the sender's mind, Tessa had clairvoyantly picked up images of the other three. Parapsychologists know this result well. They call it ESP displacement. Following normal Ganzfeld procedure, Dr. Nancy Sondo had placed Tessa in the soundproof room at the ASPR in New York. Relaxed on a couch, Tessa was fitted with headphones down which white sound was played. A soothing noise like surf. Over her eyes, half ping-pong balls were taped and a red lamp was switched on, producing a red haze. Tessa's perception was reduced to a bland, dreamlike uniformity. This weird-looking environment is thought to be conducive to good psi. Ganzfeld is a German word meaning whole field, and is a technique which deliberately cuts down input from the normal five senses in order to focus the mind upon receiving ESP information. In our experiment, in another part of the building, John Lamartine, a volunteer from the staff of the ASPR, was handed a randomly chosen set of four slides in an envelope. Without looking at them, he projected one against a screen. For half an hour, Lamartine stared at the chosen slide while Tessa recorded her mind's eye impressions from her windowless, rose-tinted cubicle down the corridor. The judging procedure is that, after the test, Tessa is shown all four slides and is invited to say which she thought she saw and to place them in ranking order. Only if she picks the correct target as number one is the experiment judged a success. The odds for getting it right by chance are 1 in 4. The target slide, a flock of birds, Tessa placed last, as the picture she was most sure she had not seen. The surprise was that she named two of the other three slides and described the third in recognizable, general terms. One picture was of a wooden, Viking longboat sailing towards camera. Tessa talked about surf and then said the front of a ship. Like a Viking ship. The pointy bit, which I think used to be a bird? Just the front of it. A second slide was the head and shoulders of a statue of a meditating Buddha. Tessa's words were eyelashes, long eyelashes. A very big eye, like when you are right up close. It's a Buddha's eye, and they are closed. The final slide was of soldiers and Tessa described various aspects of warfare. Dr. Sondo gave her verdict. This has to be considered a direct miss. Even if she had got it right, we would have wanted to do a series of say 30 trials to correlate it to other variables, like how she was feeling or who the sender was. But, having said that, it was an interesting miss. Although the target was birds, Tessa talked about a wooden Viking ship with a bird, which seemed almost to combine two of the pictures. And she talked about a Buddha with closed eyes, which very directly named another picture. The other slide was of a group of African soldiers with fixed bayonets, all fiercely grimacing and running through a jungle. Dr. Sondo's comment was, Tessa seemed to have caught aspects of this picture. She had a lot of aggressive images, a shark's mouth and metal points and explosions and war imagery. Although, of course, that is weaker than naming something directly, like the wooden ship or the Buddha. Dr. Sondo then performed a test parapsychologists sometimes use if they feel a subject may be clairvoyantly viewing a set of slides rather than telepathically getting the individual target. She compared Tessa's descriptions to another set of slides. She put photographs of Tessa's four slides, the birds, the longboat, the Buddha and the soldiers, side by side and randomly drew another envelope from the large box of possible targets. We put these four new pictures alongside the others and looked for any resemblances to Tessa's scans felt utterances. There were almost no similarities between the two packs, and the slides in Tessa's test matched up well with her descriptions, the new set did not. Dr. Sondo stressed that we had not done enough tests to reach scientific conclusions. There are various ways to think about it. You might consider Tessa got information clairvoyantly from the entire pack of pictures, which means there was no sender involved. There have been experiments like that, where a target is designated electronically and no one sees it. Some have been successful, and it's not really clear we need a sender in these experiments, but the subjects are often more comfortable with the idea of telepathy than clairvoyance. Another possibility, with results like Tessa's, is that she could have gotten the information precognitively from the future, by going forward to the time when she sat with all four pictures in front of her. A third possibility is she might get the pictures telepathically from my mind, since I knew the possible pictures that might come up in the different sets. Then again, none of these possibilities might be the right category. It might be something else. Dr. Sondo showed me other examples of ESP displacement from her collection of Ganzfeld experiments. In some tests, all four target pictures were more or less precisely named. There were numerous orthodox Ganzfeld hits, where subjects beamed straight in on the target picture in extraordinary detail. For instance, some fruit on a table was described right down to the pattern of the tablecloth. As a student, Dr. Sondo was a volunteer subject in successful Ganzfelds. In view of the general skepticism amongst scientists for claimed ESP phenomena, I asked for her assessment of the evidence for psi. To me, they really are phenomena. You can demonstrate it experimentally, you can see it happening, but the interpretation is very foggy. It's as if we are back in the 16th century studying electricity. I think it's a universal human ability which most of the time happens below the level of conscious awareness. I think it's everywhere, and it's more like gravity than like a meteorite. It's happening all the time and we're just not looking at it. We don't understand what is going on, but it has to do with the physical world, with how consciousness interacts somehow with matter and energy and time. Physics is incomplete, but this is a physical phenomenon. It has an explanation. It is tremendously exciting, but I wish more people were working on it. You need a mass of critical minds to think about a problem before you really get a breakthrough, and not enough people are thinking about this question. Ironically, in the last year, 4 of 8 research institutions studying psi in the West closed down for lack of funds. One of these was the Psychophysical Research Laboratory in Princeton, USA, run by Charles R. Norton, an acknowledged Ganzfeld pioneer since the 1970s, when the technique developed out of experiments in dream telepathy at the Maimonides Medical Center, Brooklyn, New York. Experiments that seemed to confirm the ancient belief in psychic dreams. Dreamers picked up thoughts from other minds, from senders who targeted images to sleeping subjects. The trouble was that an experiment took all night. R. Norton knew there were other altered states of consciousness where psi powers seemed strong, such as hypnosis and meditation. He reasoned that dreams, meditation and hypnosis had two things in common: physical relaxation and sensory deprivation. From that observation, Ganzfeld evolved. When we are dreaming, our brains are essentially shut off from our normal senses, and so information from other sources might leak in, R. Norton told me. The stars are always in the sky, but we can only see them at night when it's not heavily overcast. It means we have to clear the mind to unmask psychic impressions. R. Norton looked at Hindu meditation techniques, where a yogi sets out to obtain intuitive knowledge by shutting down normal sensory input until the mind is dissolved and self-illumination begins. Ganzfeld's aim, by a similar technique, is to intuitively obtain knowledge of what is going on in someone else's mind in another room. Judged by the videotapes R. Norton played for me in Princeton, there have been numerous startling successes where subjects describe pictures as accurately as if they were standing in front of them. One woman, eyes covered by ping pong balls in a remote cubicle, was trying to home in on a clip from a television documentary film, a cheetah bounding across an African plain. She began seeing a cat, but within a few seconds saw the scene so vividly she correctly identified it as part of an episode from the Life on Earth series presented by David Attenborough. R. Norton found he got excellent results by targeting moving film clips, instead of static slides. A famous newsreel clip of a suspension bridge swaying and buckling in a strong wind, before collapsing, was described remotely as something swaying in the wind. Some thin, vertical object, a ladder-like bridge over some kind of chasm that's waving in the wind. It's not vertical, it's horizontal, and I see it opening in the middle, as the bridge collapses. Another example was a spider spinning a circular web. This was seen first as basket weaving and the web as a shape like the vanes of a windmill, before being correctly named. A still photograph of a fire eater expelling a torrent of flames from his mouth was remotely viewed as a volcano with molten lava. I have a figure of water for putting out flames. Suddenly I'm biting my lip as though that is something to do with it. The lips I see are bright red, reminding me of the flame image earlier. Sometimes the viewer is both precise and impressionistic. In a scene from a movie, a gladiator battles with a huge figure, half man, half beast. This is described as looks like a centaur, like a man-horse combination, but not a man sitting on a horse. Then, as the towering figure raises a club above its head, something like the Statue of Liberty's hand holding a torch. This is remarkably close to what the silhouetted figure looked like at that moment. Some images are perceived gradually. A black and white American eagle swooping with outstretched wings was something that will fly, a parrot with long feathers going onto a perch, a great, huge eagle, wings spread out, head of an eagle, white head and dark feathers. At times, an image is captured in spirit but apparently never seen directly. the head of George Washington, the famous portrait used on U.S. postage stamps, was described as the Lincoln Memorial, Abraham Lincoln sitting there, it's the 4th of July, all kinds of fireworks bombs bursting in air. There seemed no universal law applicable to these varied Gansfeld hits. Some viewers got an impression, sensing the mood of the image without seeing it clearly, some built up from an impression to a precise picture, and some homed in on the target almost at once. Some were especially dramatic. Film of a fiery inferno was followed by a bright shot of the sun, which suddenly became a black disk, surrounded by a glowing corona, as a total eclipse occurred. The remote viewer said, I see the color red. Red, 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 I have a sunburn, a kind of cartoon sun, where you can see each spike around the sphere. In another movie clip, a group of young men in 40s style suits and trilby hats roll an old car into a lake. To their horror they see a girl's face appear at the back window. She screams soundlessly as the vehicle sinks below the water. The opening shot is of a young man in a rakish hat, brim turned up. This is seen as fedora hat turned up very much at the back, a type of car, a big roundish car from the 1940s, seen from the back window bumping up and down, cars standing still, a big mouth opening, yelling but no sound. R. Norton has many examples like this. As I watched a dozen, one after the other, the explanation at the back of my mind, that these are coincidences, thrown up occasionally in a large number of tests, began to appear increasingly unlikely and ultimately quite foolish. These viewers, with every subject under the sun to choose from, describe the targets in such fulsome and precise detail that they must either be part of an elaborate hoax or are truly viewing the scene or object by some process unknown to our five senses. Not that R. Norton bases any claims for his work on individual experiments. His overriding concern is statistics and the results are certainly thought-provoking. In 1,200 individual trials over the last 15 years, where random guesses would statistically be expected to produce a success rate of 25%, the Gansfeld average has been 34%, a 9% markup on chance. The mathematical odds against chance are in the trillions to one, and even critics of parapsychology now acknowledge the results cannot be due to chance, he says. Over the last decade, there has been a lively academic debate about the scientific value of the Gansfeld results. One suggestion is that overkeen parapsychologists have somehow been exaggerating the figures of their success rates. In answer to this, R. Norton has computerized Gansfeld as far as possible and recently published an article in an American scientific journal, jointly with one of Gansfeld's major critics, the skeptical parapsychologist Dr. Ray Hyman. We agree the results so far cannot be due to chance and are not likely to be due to improper selections of favorable data. However, we still disagree over whether this data constitutes evidence for psi or for some form of error that has not been detected. In his most recent series of computer control tests, 355 trials over 6 years, Charles R. Norton again produced a 34% success rate. He estimates the odds against chance at 20,000 to 1 for this series. We feel now the burden of proof is on the skeptics to say why these results should not be accepted, he said. The evidence for psi is very strong but is still not generally accepted by the scientific community, mainly because they are not aware of the better research going on. In some Gansfeld tests, R. Norton's subjects have scored higher than 34%. Working with students from the New York College of Performing Arts, a highly intelligent group with a high degree of rapport between sender and viewer, there was an average success rate of 50%, doubling the 1-in-4 ratio ascribed to chance. After years of research, R. Norton's verdict on psi is this: if psi is real, it would appear we have capabilities that extend beyond the nervous system. That we are able, in some way, not correctly understood, to obtain information from a distance, sometimes even from the future. This begins to sound like science fiction. And at this stage we are very much like people rubbing strange stones together and getting sparks. We need a theory, and we also need the kind of resources that will allow us to develop these sparks into a higher level of functioning. If claims made for psi are correct, and we believe some of them are, this casts an entirely different light on how we view the nature of man and his place in the physical world. That's really the important thing about parapsychology in my view. It stands as a bridge between science and philosophy. Chapter 5, The Dream Laboratory. In the end, the only event 5 in my life worth telling are those when the imperishable world erupted into this transitory one. That is why I speak chiefly of inner experiences, amongst which I include my dreams and visions. Carl Jung, in 1962. Dr. Montague Ullman, a New York psychiatrist, launched a scientific experiment at the Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn. A dream laboratory to test popular beliefs about telepathy and precognition. Can dreamers really see what is happening elsewhere, and can dreams foretell the future? His verdict was that such ancient beliefs might well be true, according to the evidence of more than 100 published scientific tests at the center. By the time the dream laboratory closed its doors 6 years later, it had paved the way for future Ganzfeld and remote viewing experiments. It had also set the scientific world alight with controversy. Orthodox science claimed most efforts to repeat the dream lab results for telepathy were failures, but some negative results were obtained in dubious circumstances, as we shall see later in this chapter. In New York in the summer of 1990, Dr. Ullman told me he thought the dream laboratory had at least demonstrated that dream telepathy and precognitive dreams could be reproduced and studied under tight experimental conditions. It's a difficult experiment, time-consuming and expensive, and perhaps that's why it hasn't been pursued as extensively as it merits, he said, a little sadly. Today the question of whether our dreams can put us in touch with the paranormal is still unresolved. Dr. Ullman certainly believes that our dreams can tune us into a level of consciousness he calls transcendental. Is this the dimension that suggests an aspect of mind which may be capable of surviving physical death? The story of the dream lab experiments and the history of that fascinating human pastime, the dream, are highly relevant to the possibility of survival after death. Dr. Ullman told me we all begin to dream about an hour and a half after falling asleep and have about 4 periods of dreaming each night. Ullman believes our dreams reflect 4 dimensions of human existence: biological, psychological, social, and a 4th dimension that can be called cosmic, transcendental, or even spiritual. People would benefit by listening to their dreams and working with them. Dreams are a terribly underutilized natural resource in civilized society. All of us are dreamers, and dreams should be universally accessible, but they are not. Work with dreams stops at the clinician 5 door. A dreaming consciousness does not play tricks. It reflects honestly where we are emotionally, not where we like to think we are or would like others to think we are. The first part of our dreams is about our immediate personal life, our vulnerability. But dreams are open-ended and can take us into this other realm of the paranormal or cosmic. This dimension, perhaps more important than the personal, occasionally breaks through, typically at times of crisis, when someone is ill, in danger, or experiences an accident or sudden death. We know this dimension exists, but don't know much more about it. It manifests itself in strange ways. Mystical experiences and perhaps the paranormal are going to be our guide into this area, but at this point it's a TMS of vast unknown. Today's debate about the nature and meaning of dreams is as old as civilization. In Babylon, ancient Egypt, Greece, Roman China, thousands of years ago, dream diviners and mystics interpreted dreams for rich and poor alike. In those days, they had no doubt dreams were paranormal events. In some cultures, sleep was regarded as a secondary life and a dream was a memory of that existence. The 20th century debate about telepathy and dreams began in antiquity. Of the ancient Greeks, Aristotle said dreams sprang naturally from the dreamer's everyday life, whereas Pythagoras believed dreams could have a supernatural origin. The late Roman philosopher Macrobius said there were 5 categories: Ordinary dreams unworthy of analysis, symbolic and mysterious dreams requiring an interpretation, dreams that were communications from gods, phantasms or nightmares, and visions offering glimpses of the future. Visionary dreams were much valued.